everybody. Welcome to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday, and we've got a great interview lined up for you today. Now, I want to make a mention. You'll get the entire interview. The only segment of today's show you won't hear is our Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. Why? Because that's under Stitcher Premium. We want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to hear these remarkable interviews of these incredible true crime stories. But for only $5 a month, you can subscribe to Stitcher Premium. That'll give you the entire episode. That includes the entire interview you're about to hear, plus Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals, and every episode of Darkness Radio, the best in paranormal podcasting. All 1,000-plus episodes commercial-free. And if that's still not enough reason for you to want to subscribe, you don't just get True Crime Tuesday and Darkness Radio, which, let's face it, for $5 a month, that's pretty valuable. You get every other show underneath the Stitcher umbrella. That means hundreds of thousands of hours of your favorite type of podcast programming commercial-free. Nobody got time for commercials. So if you're interested, then make sure you go subscribe now to Stitcher Premium. Use code word Darkness Radio, all one word, Darkness Radio, for some deep discounts for an entire year's savings. Go do that right now. Take advantage of the special and be able to listen to Darkness Radio, True Crime Tuesday, and all of the other amazing programs across Stitcher's platform. Go subscribe right now. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of True Crime Tuesday. Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, along with me, Mr. Tim Dennis. We've got Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals coming up a little bit later on in the program. If you are a subscriber through Stitcher Premium, you will get that part of the show. If you are just listening to this on our regular stream, you'll get our entire interview. If you'd like to hear the Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals section, simply sign up for Stitcher Premium. Not only do you get all of True Crime Tuesday, the complete episode, but you also get all of the rest of our Darkness Radio programs and the tens of thousands of other hours of other great programming that Stitcher has to offer. So if you want to go subscribe now, go subscribe. Use the code word Darkness Radio for deep discount savings on your first year. All right, let's get started. Now, normally, folks, we talk about serial killers. We talk about stalkers. We talk about some of the most heinous and horrific crimes and crime waves in the world. Today, we're going to take a different aspect and a different look at true crime. We've got a great guest joining us here today, part of one of America's oldest families and Manhattan royalty. And you probably recognize the last name. This is an interesting book. It's comical. It's a fun look at somebody's life that's gone through quite a bit. And the book is called Bob Goes to Jail, a Memoir. Joining us today is Rob Sedgwick. Rob, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me, sir. It's great to be here.
I'm looking at this, the family lineage. So is this Edie Sedgwick? Was Andy Warhol's muse? Is that right?
Yeah, she was kind of the it girl in the 60s. She's my cousin and part of the family. And she, she and Andy Warhol kind of ruled the style section in the 60s. Bob Dylan had an affair with her, Lou Reed. I'm pretty sure like a Rolling Stone has written about her in Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat and a couple of kind of, you know, tuneful tunes.
And then you have a brother, at least. You have a brother who's a painter, Nico Sedgwick. Your sister,
Nico's amazing.
Your sister, some people might recognize. She's just this little indie actress named Kira Sedgwick. You know, just been in a couple dozen great movies and amazing programs. So, and brother-in-law, of course, Kevin Bacon. So you've got, what an amazing pedigree and people to be surrounded by. What was it like for you to be part of such an amazing and eclectic family?
Normal, because that's your family. So you're just, that's what you're born with. That's what you're with. So I didn't think much of it one way or another. I mean, you know, we were and are remain really close. So, you know, it was not that big a deal. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I mean, if all of a sudden I was like hanging out with LeBron James on the Lakers, I'd be flipped out. You know, that would be amazing. But if I was playing for the team and like I was an NBA player and he was my teammate, it's like, oh yeah, LeBron's great, but he's
playing, he's a coworker.
That's not that big a deal. Yeah, it's not that big a deal. So you know.
But and obviously you've been an actor. You're an acting coach, a fitness trainer. You've got an incredible life yourself. But so many strange twists in this. And we do have a link up for the book today on today's program guide, folks, so you can find it. Remember, please do me a favor. When you get the books, make sure that you rate and review the books to help the authors out and get the book seen even more. It's
Available on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. So it's pretty available, yeah.
And Kindle, audiobook, and paperback. So there is a way for any one of you that likes books and wants to take it along with you. I'm currently working through it myself through audiobook version, which I'm appreciating and enjoy quite a bit. Talk to me a little bit about your life and growing up. What was it like for you? I mean, obviously you're not as affected because, like you said, you were in the eye of the hurricane with the family and friends that you have and are surrounded with. But what was life like for Rob Sedgwick growing up?
Well, I mean, I don't really how it was for me growing up, I don't think is that interesting. And what the book focuses on is it's more of a story. And I think the memoir tag is kind of unfortunate because it really is a story. It focuses on that year of when I got busted to sentencing. And it's sort of from the point of view of someone who's, you know, complete fish out of water. It's not like the rugged, gritty law and order person who's like, yeah, I've been through this a million times. It's like if all of a sudden you were a drug dealer and you were caught, you'd be like, oh, my God, I've never done this before. And I have real guns at me. Ah,
well, that's why you think it's fascinating to know about your life, you know, earlier on as well, because it's exactly what you said. It's not like this was the life of a hardened criminal that was born into squalor and is fighting and scratching to make their way through life.
No, not at all. No.
Right.
No.
That's why I think it's important to kind of set that stage for listeners as well to understand who you were and you know who you are at this point how this happened to you.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, from that point of view, it makes sense that it's sort of like, because the book exam is like how someone like me ended up like that. And it was essentially like from a severe lack of guidance. And my parents were married in the 60s. And then they got divorced in 69. My mother met my stepfather, Ben Heller, who I don't know if your listeners are familiar with abstract expressionism, but Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko,
right,
sort of the titans of art. Mm-hmm. Barnett Newman, Clifford Still. He had what the greatest abstract expressionist art collection in the world that in today's monies would be several billion dollars. And so we came into that from when my mom met my stepfather in 70, I think it was, or 69. But we had been raised already. We had been raised with my mom and my father, and it was kind of, you know, middle. I mean, there was nothing exciting about it. We never wanted for anything, but it was more normal upbringing. And then all of a sudden my mother is aligning herself with this guy and it's a museum, you know? So we were just, and it's really startling. And if you ever seen that kind of money before, it's shocking. It's really shocking and you have nothing to contextualize it. And what we got left alone an awful lot, which was fine. And that was kind of New York at that time. I mean, you know, we'd go out, play on the streets, meet kids on the streets, bringing them upstairs. But they would, as we got older, they tended to go away, leave us alone. And kids untended kind of with that kind of access, you can get yourself in a lot of trouble, which is what we did. And, you know, and it really like, whoa, you know, cause you don't have any guidance, you don't have any discipline. So, then my stepfather, when he sold Blue Poles in 74, which is a Jackson Pollock masterpiece that the Australian government owns now, he sold it to the Australian government in 74 for $2.1 million in 74. That was unheard of sum for a modern painting. And it certainly was, it was like Rembrandt prices. And then we moved to, and that was front page of the New York Times. This is an enormous painting. It's the size of a small swimming pool, which is like lowered out of the 10th floor, you know, onto the street. And when I came home that day from school, the painting was gone. And then we moved to this 5-floor townhouse on the east side, which is double the size of any normal townhouse. And you could not see the, and I was about, I guess, 13 or 14 at this time. And you could go a long time without seeing the parents, and you could get into a lot of trouble. And they hired this sort of bunch of people who worked for us who were just, you know, really out there. Like, they got conned out of a lot of money. They ripped off my mother. They had no idea what was going on. They were so disengaged. And then they ended up, I don't know if you've gotten this far in the book, a guy called Linus, who we would end up getting high with and cocaine. And we had the best cocaine in the city because his brother had been the dealer.
How old were you when that started to come into your life?
16-ish. And, okay. And the guy, Linus's brother, he did 2 years state for cocaine distribution. So we were doing all this stuff and drinking first thing in the morning and to get through school. And all the while, the parents, frankly, kind of ignorant about what was going on. I mean, just sort of saw us doing another path. Now, that happened to be also a lot of what was going on in the 70s. I mean, kids were sort of latchkey kids. You know, they were just left to their own devices. And parents of that generation were just sort of figuring it out. But we were that on steroids. And
I grew up in the 70s as well. And, you know, I was kind of a latchkey kid, but without all of that, you know, surrounding us. But yeah. That's what I said. It's an interesting aspect to hear how this happens. Now, did your parents, do you think that they knew that this was going on? But it just,
I think they had some idea, but not much. I certainly don't think they knew about the pot because you can't hide that. They certainly didn't know about the cocaine. I think they had a notion about the booze and how much, but there were also lots of psychedelics and mushrooms and, you know, all sorts of other interesting drugs, which I, perhaps you may be vaguely aware of. I don't know.
I've heard tell of them. I can't say that I've.
Yeah, but I'm sure you've never indulged in any of them. But
no,
I mean, you've seen other people going down the wicked path of dissolution, right. And you know. But it was. But also, it's like, yeah, and it was money and stuff like that. But if you take all that away, it was probably the same thing that you and maybe some of your listeners went through, you know. But the only difference was the house we were in was so big that we wouldn't see them for a week. And then they would go away to, my stepfather had a country place in East Hampton, which is like the fanciest place in the world now. It was pretty fancy then, but now it's sort of ridiculous. But they would go over for the weekend, leave us alone. And we would have parties. We would have all these sort of miscreants over. And the guy Linus was, he was kind of the oldest person there, 10 years older than us, like 28, late 20s, early 30s. But he was big drinker, as shown in the book, serious pedophile, and ended up raping one of my friends. I didn't find out till 20 years after the fact because he was so ashamed. And that's all in the book. And, you know, he would bring, and his brother would come over, who had been, as I said before, the coke dealer of New York City and 2 years state for distribution. He would come over with friends of his from prison who just got out with all sorts of interesting weapons. And so this is what we were around. And
now,
if you're a parent.
Can you explain that to me, though? I mean, you're around these people. Obviously, mm-hmm. You know, is it kind of a thrill to be in the presence of somebody like this? Is it, you know, again, is it disinfected because you've just like, oh, you know, this is just the people I know. These are the people in my neighborhood kind of feel. Because well, this is a totally different lifestyle.
When Linus brought his brother over, and his brother would bring guys with guns, that was kind of out of the ordinary. That was kind of like, wow, hey, that's serious stuff. You know, it was just such Yeah, I go around New York now, and it's so boring. You know, at least that was interesting. I mean, it was insane.
Right.
I mean, really insane, but it certainly wasn't boring. And so I guess when I look back on it, it was like, you know, but you're taking life as it comes. So that at that time, that's what life was. If I look back on it now, yeah, it was crazy. Would I let my kid grow up like that? Not on your life. No way. I don't care. I mean, I'm going to leave my kid alone when he's 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. No, that's just not going to happen. But, you know, we were left alone and with charge accounts to these fancy places. So we would order up these steaks and food. And, you know, I mean, it was just crazy. Absolutely
crazy. Kind of like out of touch with reality, kind of this.
Oh, completely out of touch.
Yeah.
Completely out of touch. And, you know, and as I said before, we would end up drinking, my brother and I especially, we would end up drinking before school. We get up at 5:36 just to deal with school. And we'd have a party before school. So we'd show up at school 8:30, whatever it was, you know, lit up. I mean, it was like, and also the guy
Linus, were the teachers aware of that? I mean, did they see or sense a problem?
You know,
or?
Some of them, I think a lot of them knew. But again, this is the era. It was like they let you get away with it. It wasn't like today where I don't know what the hell would happen. But back then, it was just, you know. And the school I ended up at was not the greatest. I did the 3 different high schools in 5-year plan. Because it was just so discombobulating. I was so discombobulated. And the last one I ended up at, you know, they kind of turned a blind eye. I was at tennis practice and I had done shots of 151 Bacardi with a friend of mine before tennis practice. And I ended up at tennis practice smashed. I mean, completely smashed. It was either the most remarkable shot I hit in my life or it went over the fence. More often than not, it went over the fence. One of the guys told tennis coach gets me the next day. And he's also like the Latin teacher. And he's like, Cedric, I heard you were drunk at practice yesterday. And I said, yes, sir, I was. And he said, if you ever do that again, you take me with you before practice. You know, I mean, it was just like that. That was the
so it was an enabling was the environment. Head. Yeah.
Yeah. And there was one guy I remember who was a doctor and he would come over and he was in the lower school and he was a really interesting intellectual guy. He would come over and bring mushrooms for us and we'd all trip in the house and stuff like that. And here's this decidedly older gentleman hanging out with us who was, you know, he must have been in his 50s and we were like 15, 16 and we were all doing mushrooms with him. He just never untoward. I mean, he never did anything sexually inappropriate with us, but it was just, he was a little out there, you know, or getting high with him and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was a different time. I mean, teacher, if you were a teacher who did that today, you not only be fired, you'd probably be put in jail. I mean,
right.
So it was a different time. It was a really different time.
Did that make growing up, I'm trying to find the right word for it, harder? Because once you're out from underneath that umbrella of this wealthy family and everything, you're and left to your own devices, is it a brutal kind of adjustment to have to make, or did you never really get to that point?
I was so drunk the whole time. I don't know what happened. I mean, I was, and the thing is, I think, you know, yes, there's money and the glitz and the pipes and whistles and stuff like that. But if you take all that away, any child who's brought up with no skill set, with no tools, with no guidance, they're all going to end up like that. You know, unless you are lucky and you find a discipline early on, like a sport, an art, you know, science, something that really grabs you and that you're really dedicated to and you're really pursuing, because that discipline will bleed into other aspects of your life. But we weren't given any of that. We kind of were vaguely with art, and my brother is an amazing artist and he started that early, but we were all getting, you know, so we were all getting high like crazy anyway. So yeah, I think that's the problem. So when put out to life, I didn't have, when I got to college, I started acting a lot. And then I took that really seriously. I was really disciplined about that. And So that started teaching me what, you know, to be organized, to have your shit together, to work hard, you know, and see results. And that was great.
Can I ask you something? Obviously, you're a father. Were you open with your children about this aspect of your life? Okay. What was that like?
I have an 8-year-old. He really doesn't know yet. And I have a 31-year-old who, if you read the book, I was dating her mother back then. And I was doing a movie. I came back from the movie. And she said she was pregnant and she wanted the baby. And we had made no plans about it or anything like that. And I said, I'm out of here. I'm not ready to be a father. And this was, this is the middle of the drug dealing and stuff like that. So I really and drinking. So I made the right call because I would have been a terrible father. Spoiler alert, she got in touch with me. My daughter did 2015. She'd never heard about me. And she told me only a couple of days ago that her mom brought her in around 2015, summer 2015, and said, I have something to tell you. Your father is not actually your father, the man she ended up marrying. And so I met my daughter and we have a terrific relationship now. And she's amazing. And she's 31, but yeah, she knows about it. And she just, you know, we're sort of still getting to know each other. So, cause I wasn't there from the get go. And my 8-year-old is 8. So he doesn't understand. So
will you, at what age, only because, you know, I mean, I've got a lot of kids. Obviously, I dabbled with marijuana and a few things growing up. And kids, you know, they ask a lot of questions. How open will you be with your 8-year-old as they grow up about, you know, do you think you would tell them about the pitfalls that you went through or just let them lead their life? Because what I've found personally is, by, you know, being open with my kids and saying, hey, yeah, you know, I smoked weed. We had alcoholics in the family, so I tried to avoid alcohol. I went through my little binges, but that wasn't good for me. I didn't enjoy it and in the long run. But, you know, it kind of opened up a weird dialogue with my children who are then like, well, but if you were okay with smoking weed, why aren't you okay with me smoking weed? And I'm curious what, you know, I know this is a little off topic, but how do you think you'd handle this discussion with your child about drugs and what is acceptable and what isn't? As you said, you obviously wouldn't leave your children the same devices that you were left to. But where do you go in that kind of discussion? I'm curious, and I'm sure there's probably a lot of parents that are going to be riding that same rail.
Oh, I'd be totally open. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. I'm also 26 years in recovery. It'll be 26 years October 25th. And I'm a very proud member of AA. And but that drink is always like, you know, an arm's reach away. So I don't do anything anymore. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do drugs, nothing. But yeah, I'd be very open with my kid about it. And if you want to do it, go ahead. But it got me in a lot of trouble. I don't blame anyone. That's my fault. I did that. You know, nobody else put a gun to my head. But had I not been drinking and doing drugs and all that kind of stuff, this book never would have happened because I never would have made those choices. You know, I mean, you make dumbass choices when you're drinking that much and you're doing drugs and stuff. You know, there's that saying with athletes, like nothing happens. Nothing good happens after 12 o'clock. You know, it's really true. I mean, hell yeah, I would tell him. And there's alcoholism in my family, and if he was getting too much, I would tell him. You know, I had a cousin who just went into rehab. I mean, it's really dangerous. It's funny, they legalize this stuff, but I mean, the fascinating thing is I have friends who stop drinking for one reason or another. They're not necessarily alcoholics, but they feel like they're drinking too much. And they say about how everyone is throwing a drink in their face. Like, why aren't you drinking? Oh, then I'm not going to drink. If you're not going to drink, people get uncomfortable, you know? And, it's so prevalent in our society, but yeah, I would tell my kid, he's so opposite me. I think kids tend to go that way. I don't think he's ever going to do anything. He's very sharp. He's very science and math and super smarty pants and very organized. And so I doubt that'll happen. But yes, I'm always very open about it. I'm open to anyone about it, because if they want to talk about it, chances are something's going on with them. And right. I would always like to show people, you know, tell people, as in AA, my experience, strength, and hope. And if that saves someone from going doing that, good. You know, I mean, there's no con in not drinking.
Right.
You know, there isn't. I mean, it's just like, yeah, great. You know, you have red wine, you know, a claret, you know, some expensive thing. Great, you know. But, you know, leading a good, healthy life and stuff like that, you're not doing that. What are you missing? Is life that much better if you're a little buzzed? Really? You know, I don't know where you live, but you know, if you, 'cause you're going in nature or something like that, or you're experiencing some beautiful piece of art, or you're listening to the Beatles and having a great time, is booze or getting high going to make that better? I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, if you can do it in moderation, great. But it's just...
Right. That can slip away from you very quickly, and it's a slippery slope
once man.
You start down it, especially at a young age.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's very... I mean, you know, and if you really... to check out the stats, I mean, how many people die from drinking in this country? You know, accidents, bar fights, you know, people who decide they want to go shoot people, you know, I'm sure they've had a couple of belts beforehand. You know, it really clouds your judgment. You know, it's dangerous. It's really, really dangerous. And I thank God that I don't have to do that anymore, man. It's a lot better.
Yeah, well, let's say, you know, obviously we're going to get into that aspect of your life. Again, folks, the book is called Bob Goes to Jail, a Memoir. We have a link up for the book on today's program guide so you can find it easily. We'll be back. We've got more to discuss with our guest, Rob Sedgwick, right here on True Crime Tuesday. This is True Crime Tuesday. Our guest today, Rob Sedgwick. Bob Goes to Jail, a Memoir. That's the name of the book. You can find the link for that on today's program guide, so make sure you check it out. Or go over to darknessradio.com, click on the store tab. You'll find our Amazon store there with all of the books that you hear covered on our true crime and paranormal programming. Fascinating look, and I appreciate you kind of going back a little bit further with us, Rob, to give us a unique perspective into your life, you know, growing up and what that was like, because, you know, let's face it, we're a voyeuristic world. People like that insight into the world of the rich and famous, but also to get an idea of how do things kind of jump the rails? What really happens in those cases? But, you know, obviously you started dabbling in drugs and, well, involving yourself in drugs and alcohol pretty early on. Once you got into college and you were
more like head first, more like head first.
Diving. Once you are in college, you said that you kind of had that direction of wanting to be an actor, and was that helping you? Or, you know, I mean, we hear actor stories all the time that lend themselves right down the road to alcoholism and drug abuse because of what they're doing and what they're, you know, trying to pull from. Did that get worse for you or better?
I still drank a lot in college, but when it came to work, I worked really hard and I ended up doing probably more shows than most. And I decided at that point, I thought about writing, but I went to Bennington, but that's a pretty heavy duty writing school. And I just didn't have the tools or the wherewithal to do that. So I ended up, deciding I really wanted to act, and I put in a lot of time, and I ended up doing a lot more than probably my other classmates, because it was a liberal arts school. Nothing disparaging to them, but it was, they were sort of dabbling in this and dabbling, you know, getting a liberal arts education, sort of tasting everything. I really focused on that. So by the time I came out of school, I was really ready to go. I got my first gig, and for the first couple of years, I did a lot of work, and So that was great. But the problem with, I didn't go to a graduate school. So they don't tell you that, hey, there are a lot of times when you're not working as an actor, you better figure that out. So I had, as I was with the kid, I had a lot of idle time. And when I had idle time, I just got into a lot of trouble. So, and then I got into the dealing, literally, I don't know if you've gotten this far in the book, but literally I was just not getting work. This is about 1988, 4 years after I graduated. And I was feeling sorry for myself, and I would get drunk, and I would listen to Neil Young, and I would weep. And I was walking with my dog along the street, and I ran into one of my brother's best friends. His name is Jordan in the book, and he was a big pot dealer. And when I say big pot dealer, I mean, people are thinking, oh, that's not a big deal. He would deal in tonnage. So he made a lot of money. So he was on the street talking on a payphone, and I was feeling lonely, and I was judging this guy all over the place. And we would hang out in groups, and I would always look down on him because he was, you know, a drug dealer. But on this particular day, I was feeling sorry for myself and sad, and I really wanted to be magnanimous and reach out and, you know, be friends with him because he was best friends with my brother. And I saw him was talking on this payphone on Broadway, and I said, are you doing Nudge Nudge? And he said, hi. And I said, wink, wink. And he was like, yeah, I am, actually. I said, I got to load up the street. And I said, oh, well, why don't you come over to the apartment I'm in? I was staying at my grandparents' apartment because I couldn't afford rent, and they went away to the West Indies for half the year, and my grandfather let me stay in the apartment. So I go to this very, you know, Upper West Side, old world, you know, from the 30s apartment, 12 rooms, very stately, beautiful, on 84th and Broadway. And he goes up, so we go upstairs, and he makes some phone calls, and I'm pretending not to hear them, and they're all about drugs and where they're going to drop them off and how much money and yada, yada. And he comes back in, and he said, thanks a lot for letting me use the phone. And I said, of course, and I insist anytime you're in this neighborhood, I insist you come up here and use the phone anytime you want. And he said, really? I said, as a matter of fact, I insist you use this apartment for any contraband or anything that you're doing, because it was huge. And he said, really? And he looked at the entire apartment, and he came back. He said, this could really work out. I said, I insist it work out. And he said, yeah. And you would be paid. And I don't need to be paid. He said, yeah, you'd be paid. And I do two loads a month, and you would get $3,000 a pop. So that's $72,000 a year sitting around with your thumb up your ass. And I was like, great. That sounds wonderful.
Yikes.
But I'm such an idiot because this is the funny aspect, because I had no idea what I was getting involved in. So when the first load came, and that's when the book opens about, you know, I have a load in front, and he had a load in back. And we'd been dry for a while. But anyway, the first load was these two refrigerator boxes weighing 250 pounds each, crammed full with pot. That's a quarter ton. This is in 1988. That had a street value back then of $1.2 million.
Holy
so we
cow.
Were bringing that in, we were bringing that up in the elevator in this very old, rickety, like from the 20s or 1900 elevator that would constantly get stuck. And so we bring that up. And of course, and there was a driver there too. So Jordan, the driver, me, and some old woman was in the car, in the elevator with the 250 pounds of pot, and the elevator got stuck, and I knew how to reactivate it. But the woman was like, what's in that huge box? And I said, and I jumped into some fabulous lie really quickly because I didn't know what the ramifications of this were. So I just jumped into some stupid, oh, they're wonderful shirts. These are friends of mine. They're opening up a store downtown in Tribeca. And it's just, but they lost the key to the new store there, you know, going into, so they're going to use my apartment for a while. And she said, oh, isn't that wonderful? And I said, yes. And the clothes are exquisite. You know, I was acting all namby-pamby. And meanwhile, Jordan and the driver were turning green because they knew if we ever got caught with this, we're in big trouble. So the woman thinks it's very entertaining about the clothes. She leaves. We get up into the apartment and they're all like, you're amazing. You're perfect for this. You know, your acting skills will come in great handy, really handy. So that's what I did for a couple of years until we, you know, until, as the book indicates, got caught. And then I was looking at 5 to 40 in jail. I had a contract on my head from the Mexican mob. And it was, yeah, it was a very, that's what makes it an interesting story. So
I like that you're just a
moron.
I like that it's just kind of glossary. Oh, yeah, and I had a hit out on me from the Mexican mob and got busted.
All of it, the shit hit the fan, the whole right. Everything. It's like, you know, you wake up in life and you have your coffee and you go outside or you do whatever you're doing. All that got sent on its ear. And life completely changed once we got caught. So it's just, yeah. And the reason I dip back in time in the book is to sort of buttress how I ended up making these, you know, and I say at the end of that chapter, when I agreed to this partnership, I say my last sentence in that chapter, and on that day, God created the moron, me, you know, because it's so stupid.
Right.
I mean, it's laughably stupid. And the thing is, and the book, I hope it comes across funny, because it is funny, because the choices are so dumb. But that's how.
It's dumb, but you can see the allure when people, oh, I would never do this. Why would somebody fall into that?
Yeah.
You hear 72 grand a year to sit with your thumb up your ass. Tim and I sit with our thumb up our ass and we barely make minimum wage. So I can understand why. That would
and
be.
And this was in 1988, when that was a lot of money.
Well, yeah. Well, it's still a lot of money in 2021, right? But yeah, if you got that back then, that had to be, you know, probably closer to, you know, $200,000 to $250,000 in income,
probably
higher, depending on where you are. But that's remarkable. Yeah. So I can understand that allure, and especially when you're getting sunshine pumped up your ass, man, you're so good at this, Rob. You're a natural. You're an actor. You could pull this.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. That's exactly
what
you
wanted. That was great. Oh, I thought, and I started buying gangster gear, like marshmallow sneakers and sweatpants and, you know, a Harley Davidson cap that I wore jauntily askew. You know, I mean, it was just like, it was ridiculous. And then all this pot would come in and all these dealers would come in. And, you know, you think like, wow, I'm part of something. You know, I'm a worker among workers. You know, I'm contributing to something larger than myself. It's the stupidest fucking thing. And then at one point I had this shitty mattress in one of the bedrooms. And this is my grandparents' apartment, you have to understand. And I opened the door and there was this hill of cash, all 20s. And I'm looking at this going, oh, my God. And I said to Jordan later, I said, that must have been $1 million on my bed. And he said, it was $1.2 million. And then all I thought was like, fuck acting. What do I need to act for? This is a hell of a lot more fun. It's much more lucrative. I'm having a great time. And then I was dating this incredibly hot girl who was every guy's dream in the gym. And we were getting along great. And, you know, it was just wonderful. I mean, so life was a parade. It was a bowl of cherries, you know. And then I went to, and again, I don't know how far you went in the book, but the guy Linus, the guy who was the crazy guy who worked for us, I went to his brother's place, the guy who did 2 years stay for cocaine distribution. He had, at this point, changed his life around. He became a lawyer at NIAC. And I went to visit him to talk to him about this. And this is a guy who did 2 years state, hard time for what he did. And I told him everything. And he was all excited. His eyes were getting misty, you know, remembrances of deals past. And isn't this exciting? And he was really getting into it. And I said, so what do you think? And then he became a sober lawyer. He said, stop right now. And I said, but you were smiling so much and you thought it was so wonderful. And he said, yeah, it sounds great. But if you get caught, it's going to go down really bad. They're in the midst of trying to change the drug laws now. So it's not just a wrist slap and a fine anymore. They're looking for a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence. Hasn't been passed yet, but that's what they're getting in the works. So you could get in big trouble, and jail is not a walk in the park. But I was so upset with him, but I'm having so much fun. And he said, look, you wanted my opinion. That's my opinion. And I was so upset. And I remember leaving there with my dog, who's a huge character in the book. And I thought, you know, oh, God, to give up this. And I feel like an international spy. And I feel like James Bond. And I have so much money. And then I thought, fuck this. If I go down, I'm going to go down swinging. I'm not giving this up. and, you know, continued on this very enlightened, asinine path for a while.
Did you just feel like you were untouchable? I mean, obviously you were trying to live that lifestyle, but were there sleepless nights? Were there gut turning moments of, fuck, this could come crumbling down any minute?
Well, what Jordan kept saying was, it's only pot. It's only pot, not a big deal. But as time went on, real life starts really, I started thinking, what if this breaks bad? What if this breaks bad? And of course, the last, when we got popped, and again, I don't know how far you got in that in the book, but I knew something was up the last load, because the boxes had been opened, the pods were exposed. The boxes were sealed airtight in these pods and stuff, so you couldn't smell anything. But the last load, the truck was weird. The refrigerator boxes were open. The pods were exposed. And I thought something is really bad. And it felt just like, that felt gut-wrenchingly wrong. And we had been dry for a long time. And Jordan kept on going, you know, cash, cash, cash. You know, finally, it's in here. And had I not been as good friends with him as I was, I probably wouldn't have touched the box. But I did. And I was told by lawyers and drug enforcement agency later, and they said, had you walked away, nothing would have happened. But because you touched it, you know, that's it. You're done. And we took that box and we took it on the hand truck upstairs. And that's when we were popped. And that's when the DEA came in. And then that's when all the laughter died in sorrow.
Right. What was that like? When the DEA comes in, is it like you see in TV and movies? Is there just this swarm of activity and blue coats, what happens to you?
If you're, if you're reading the book, I mean, that's the first chapter. I open up the first chapter being busted. And what happens is, like, actors will have guns on them and be busted, and they're all emotional and like, oh my God, and they're acting all over the place. But what happens in real life, having it, firsthand experience, you just go way under, because you can't believe this is happening. And I say in the book, everything slows down. And it's like Larry Bird, how the game just slowed down for him, and like Joe Montana, everything just slowed down, and like you're underwater and you can't really believe this is happening. And because it's so cliche, and there are all these, when the DEA came swarming in, I thought they were friends of Jordan's, because they had all these guns, but they had to be water pistols because they looked like water pistols, because they looked too real to be real. And then you realize, I think, I don't know these people. So if these are friends of Jordan's, I don't know any of them. What's going on? And then before you know it, I was turned around and they were putting my hands behind my back, and I had one of those cylinder machine guns, you know, so the bullets don't go all over the place, right at my brain stem. And then I had a bunch of guns on me, and I saw myself in the mirror of the hallway with a sort of ridiculous expression on my face. And then Jordan was being pistol whipped in the corner. And then they took me down the hall, and there was an enormous sign on the elevator that said no more than 5 people in the elevator at the same time, because the elevator is so old. So all 8 of us got on the elevator, and of course it stalled. And of course, and I had handcuffs on me at this point and guns all over me. And I said, I can activate the elevator if you want me to. And they said, don't do anything stupid. And all I thought was like, what am I, Bruce Lee? I'm handcuffed and I got 25 guns on me. I mean, what the fuck are you thinking? So I kick it open. They threatened to shoot my dog. And had they done that, I wouldn't be talking to you now, because I would have been dead. And we opened the door, and there was good cop, bad cop. One guy was like, let's shoot the dog. Another guy was like, look, I got dogs. I know what it's like. If you can settle them down, we'll be okay. We opened the door, and my dog knew something was up the second he came in. He was excited for 2 seconds, and then he saw, like, wow, this is really bad. So he backed up, and he was just a superior animal, and he just sort of cooled out and relaxed and was really calm so everybody else would calm down. And things went from scary to just really bad pretty quickly. And they weren't going to shoot him or anything like that. And when I came in, I didn't get Miranda. Like, you have the right to remain silent, blah, blah, blah. The first words out of their mouth was, where's the cash? Where's the cash? Where's the cash? Where's the cash? So that shows you that they don't really care about Miranda that much. They want to know where the cash was. There wasn't any cash there. So, you know, and then you got talked through everything and they're trying to get information from you. And, you know, I answered a series of questions because I thought that would be the polite thing to do. But then after a while, they weren't very nice about the whole thing. And I realized halfway through it, I think I should talk to a lawyer. So,
and then you get
the first bit of
You get in, you see what's, you know, what's going down as they're picking this apart and you get, you know, get an attorney. How do you proceed? Is this something you feel like, well, if I throw these people under the bus, I'm a dead man. Where do you go?
This is the story of the book. You know, Jordan always promised that if anything happened, he would have a lawyer immediately. Of course, we got busted and no lawyer showed up from his end. My stepfather, who was a really abusive guy, but really came through big in this situation. He had a lawyer waiting for me when we got out for pretrial and a preliminary lawyer. And I spoke to her and she said, we have a problem. They think you're the main guy. They think you're in charge because it was your apartment. And they said, you were so calm during the arrest. And I said, what do you mean calm? I was terrified. And that's the funny thing, because when I say, like, actors will be like, oh no, I'm scared. But you just go so far down because you can't believe this is happening. You just are trying to put one foot in front of the other. And if someone said, how do you spell the word at? You would be like, I'm not quite sure how you spell at, because all cognizance goes smack out the window. So on the outside, you look actually calm. So I got that lawyer. And then after pretrial and bail was set, he had gotten me a really nice law firm. And actually, one of the lawyers is now representing Trump, if you can believe it. So my stepfather got that for me. And we posted bail, which also in the book, I want to say it was 300 grand and you had to put up 10% of that, I believe. And so I wasn't on probation, but I was on, I couldn't leave the Southern District. I was, you know, waiting for sentencing and stuff like that. And I ended up cooperating with the Drug Enforcement Agency because the lawyer said, look, we can play He-Man and go to trial and you don't say anything, but they have everything on you. And the law got passed that the judge can be your brother now. And if you're guilty by a jury of your peers, minimum, you're going away for 5 years. Minimum. And they said, I can guarantee you now, Jordan is in the other room with his lawyers, and he's talking up a storm trying to pin the whole thing on you. So I was not an experienced criminal. We didn't. And it's further, as the book goes, we never had any plan in case that if there was an emergency, break the glass and pull the thing, you know, pull the alarm thing. We didn't have any of that in place. So I cooperated with the government, and the government was like, and they're very clear. They're like, you have to tell us everything. It's not like you can be a little bit pregnant. You have to say everything. So I had to tell them everything I knew. So I sang like a bird. So that's the trip I was on. And obviously in the book, it sort of proceeds from there.
Right. Now we're doing a glossary look at this, folks. There's a lot more detail. It's a funny, charming book that will walk you through this life and give you, insights to it. But when you're in the thick of this, and even, you know, you've got the help, you've got this, it sounds like everything is just like this surreal, like,
oh yeah,
almost like you feel like you're in a movie watching the movie unfold around you.
Oh yeah. Totally. And then they said, when I was sentenced, the lawyer said, look, on TV, everyone's very emotional. In real life, when you go into that courtroom, you're going to just, your blood pressure is going to plummet and you're going to be not, you're going to look like the calmest person in the world because you're not going to believe that this is happening. So try as much as you can. You're an actor. Try to drudge up as much emotions as you can, because if that judge looks at you and doesn't think that you are remorseful, you're going away. And I got to say, when I walked into that courtroom, you felt your face on your face on your face, and you have you can't believe this is happening. And you're just like, you're almost like a Buddhist. You're so calm, or in deep meditation. That's just, you're so removed from it. You can't believe this is happening.
That's an interesting insight, because obviously we've talked on the show about criminals, and that, you know, they sit in court when this judgment is read, they sit there completely blank face, stone face, and like no emotions whatsoever. But it's an interesting insight that you give, that it's because you must feel almost like an out of body experience. Like you're watching through closed circuit TV as this shit's going down, and you're like, what is happening to me right now? Yeah. And
I agree. Reality. Sorry, Ken.
No, I was just going to say that.
I agree. I was going to say that, because every time you read in sentencing, somebody does something heinous, such and such was strangely, you know, blank or strangely emotionless during sentencing. That's because the writer has no idea that what's going through the defendant's system, they can't believe this is happening. They're freaking out inside, but outside it's just like you're numb. And I had to like dredge up all this emotion and crying and make myself like shaking and stuff like that. But I had to dredge it up as best as possible, because you're not there. You just go away. So yeah, and that whole year was just like, it's such a trip. I mean, you know, DEA would show up unannounced, you know, hookers, drugs. And a sort of Damocles over your head every day, because you don't know what's going to happen. And I remember saying my sister at one point that I wish I was away, because I was ready to go away. But this whole waiting, not knowing if you're going to go away, it's torture. It's exquisite torture all the time. Oh. And you're living on this razor's edge, literally, every day. And you're just amped up. And the hysterical thing in the book is that I ended up getting a gig as a strong arm in a drug ring on the soap opera Another World. No, One Life to Live.
Right.
And of course, when I got the gig, and I had a lot of movies coming out, but I wasn't allowed, and this is all in the book, I had a lot of movies coming out, but I wasn't allowed to audition for movies because I couldn't leave the Southern District. But a soap opera, they had always wanted me on soap operas, but a soap opera I could do because I'd shot in New York City. So my lawyers were like, get a soap opera. So I got this One Life to Live thing where I was a strong arm in a drug ring. And of course, when the lawyers found out about it, they thought it was the funniest thing in the world. When the DEA found out about it, they were all cracking up. I mean, everyone thought it was hysterical, the funniest thing in the world. I mean, here was art imitating life.
Right.
And so, you know. Like,
were you worried that that might play against you? Because then, you know, is it like you're flaunting it? Is it like you're embracing this aspect?
No. Everybody knows an actor, and it's again in the book. One of my lawyers is saying, you know, to the judge, it says, you know, he's been working in his chosen profession as a drug enforcer in a drug ring, and the entire courtroom cracked up. And then he said, and he worked in the name of this particular program escapes me. And the judge interrupted and said, I believe they're called daytime dramas, Mr. Fruschetti. And it was just like, oh yeah. So, cause it was a soap opera. But no, everyone's hip that, you know, an actor's an actor and you get what you get. But yeah, I mean, and the thing is, why I wrote the book is that I thought, because it's such a wacky tale, because right. I'm not a hardened criminal. I'm just an idiot who got into like easy money and stuff. And through, you know, kind of a shitty upbringing, not that I'm feeling sorry for myself, but if you don't, I have kids. If you don't provide guidance and discipline and stuff like that to kids, you know, you're getting, chances are you're going to get in trouble,
right,
and make their own call. And that's what happened with me. And so it led to this insane, surreal circus of a year that most people wouldn't go through. You know? And it's coming from the point of view of someone who had no background in this.
Does that affect your life going forward as in acting and that work? Do people stay away from you because you've got that stigma attached to you, or?
No, my God. I remember friends going, like, publicize this immediately. You'll get an incredible amount of publicity. But specifically, just I turned down anything back then about magazines. Oh, yeah. I got contacted by a lot of places because they wanted to blow it up because my sister was doing Tom Cruise movies, and my brother-in-law is Kevin Bacon, and they wanted to really blow it up. But my brother and I really tried to protect them, and so we didn't say anything. We just took the fifth and just, you know, said no comment on any of that stuff. So, I mean, now it's so long ago, who cares? I mean, but now it's in the book, so, you know, and people seem to be really digging the book. But back then, it was just like, no, we kept it under wraps. We didn't tell anybody, so.
Fascinating stuff. A great read. Again, it's out on Kindle, audiobook, paperback, however you want to take this book along with you. Revisiting this and writing it down, Rob, I have to ask, I mean, was there any aspect of this that really surprised you, even, you know, as you go back and retell this tale? Was, you know, any certain point of this really kind of hit you harder than any other aspect?
You mean in the writing of it?
Yes. In because that's right. You're picking a scab, and obviously you're doing it with a sense of humor and everything. But was there any element of this that really kind of surprised you as you dove back into the story of your life?
I thought it was it was funny when I wrote it. I just wanted to write about the drug stuff, and I didn't realize, like, because I thought it was a great story. I mean, let's face it. You know, sex, drugs, rock and roll. Those are all fun stories. And I knew it was a fun story because fish out of water, being in a big drug ring, Mexican cartel, blah, 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 having a contract on your head, doing walk and talks in the park, people flipping. That's fun. And it's interesting. But what during the writing of it, I found myself, because when you read it, it alternates. You'll have the front story, which was the bust, and then you'll have the second chapter is me going to an amusement park with my parents by myself, getting put on this ride that I didn't want to be on. And it was one of those loop-de-loop rides and being terrified. And I was about three and unbuckling the safety strap and wanting to climb out and get off it because I wouldn't stop it and wanting to jump out onto the grass, which I ended up doing. And, you know, so it's sort of like the chapter in the past will buttress the preceding chapter of like how I would make bad decisions, you know, because, you know, getting out of a ride at the amusement park in the middle of it is probably not a good idea. but, you know, maybe my parents should have put me on such a ride, you know. So I found myself going into the past. And so it did become this sort of excavation of, you know, because you want to get to the why of it. Why did you make these choices? You want to dig deeper. And I think when you start writing something, you start looking, you might start with an idea, but then you start really burrowing in there, like, why? What activated this decision? Why did you make these choices? What's really going on here? What's going on underneath? What's really going on, And I think that what's relatable is we've all been lost. We've all made bad decisions in our lives. We've all had to deal with the consequences of really bad decisions. And how do you make restitution for that? How do you take responsibility for that? Do you take responsibility for it? And what position does that put you in society with your family? How do you feel about yourself? How do you feel about yourself when you look at into the mirror at the end of the day? How do you deal with that? And how do you face life and these things and yourself? And how can you say to children and people who look up to you what the right thing to do is? And right. I think we all at base have those real, and who loves me and who's behind me and who's going to, you know, still stick by my side through this. I think you take all the money and the glitz and then all that kind of horse shit away. We all have these real core needs to be a part of something, to want to be loved, to want to be touched, to want to be accepted into stuff, and to make right a wrong. And I think, you know, I hope at the end of the day, really underneath, that's more of what the book's about. And also, like, my dog at that time was tripping through the book. His name is Tybalt, and he really saved my ass. I can guarantee if I didn't have that dog Tybalt, I wouldn't be talking to you now. I would be dead. I mean, he shepherded me through this whole fucking thing. And the great thing was, is that we got busted in 91. I got sober October 25th, 95, and he died in 98, which is what I end the book with. But he had me 3 years sober, and which was great. So I could sort of get back to him, because if it wasn't for Tybalt, I'd be dead. And I owe him getting sober and get my shit together. And he was really quite amazing. And he trips through, he's sort of like this, you know, at the end of the day, the book is kind of like about a boy and his dog. I mean, he really saved my ass. And I tried to make better decisions. I tried to be responsible for him, even though I was in the grip of serious alcoholism. And I remember, this isn't in the book, but I remember the day I got sober, I went to an AA meeting and I poured this vodka. I kept this vodka overnight just in case, you know, I was going nuts and I had to drink, but I didn't. I made it through the night and I poured that vodka down the drain and turned on the hot water. And it just like the smell of it was like this, like bouquet of razor blades just going up my nose. I was just like, oh my God, you've been sticking that in your system all your life. Jesus. And he came into the little kitchen. I was in this little apartment. He just looked at me so proud. He was sitting there and his chest just got bigger. And I knew that he knew that I just quit, you know, and it was really something else. So for that,
it's amazing.
Really grateful.
The cathartic and healing that animals can bring to us. That's a remarkable.
Oh my God. They're miracles. They're miracles. I mean, you know, we think we're so smart. We're all that in a bag of chips and, you know, Jesus Christ, they didn't destroy the earth. They didn't kill anybody. They didn't, you know, they're on our side. And they know us on a level that nobody else knows us. You know, so he is really remarkable. So.
Well, Rob, thank you for coming on, sharing your story with us. And if you want to find out if he ever got that price removed from his head from the Mexican mob, and more details about this, make sure you pick up a copy of the book, Bob Goes to Jail, a Memoir. Rob Sedgwick, our guest and author, thank you so much for being here with us today.
And you can get on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com.
And we've got a link right up on today's program guide to make it even easier for you. Thank you very much, Rob Sedgwick. We hope you enjoyed today's program of True Crime Tuesday. And remember, if you'd like the full episode with the Dumb Crime Stupid Criminals aspect, all you have to do is go over and subscribe now for Stitcher Premium. Use code word Darkness Radio, all one word, to get some deep discount savings for your 1 year subscription. And it will give you access to all of our archives from Darkness Radio. There's over 1,000 episodes up and available and more being added constantly. You get all of the episodes of True Crime Tuesday, and you get all of the other great programs that are part of Stitcher. Hundreds of thousands of hours of programming for $5 a month, commercial free. You can't beat that, so don't even try. Go subscribe now, and remember to use keyword Darkness Radio for those key savings.